Hey, you.
Yeah, you.
If you or someone you know is struggling with anything mentioned on today's program, please, 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 please email me at authentic1@gmail.com. That's AUTHENICK, the number 1@gmail.com. I am available 24/7, 365 to help in any way that I can. I have resources, I have open ears, an open heart, and tons of hope. I've been freely given all these things and would love to give them to you. Be good to yourselves and each other. Follow me on Twitter using the handle @authentic and my dog Marla on Instagram @djmarla.jean. During today's episode, you will hear AA or Alcoholics Anonymous mentioned multiple times. The individual expressing their thoughts and opinions on AA do not reflect AA as a whole. Don't worry, I checked with the local GSR. Enjoy.
I can't get these memories out of my mind, and some kind of madness has started to evolve.
Welcome to Authentic, where we get authentic. Yeah! My name is Nicholas Thomas Fitzsimmons Vandenhavel, but most people just call me Nick. And with me, as always, is my dog Marla.
Marla! Come here, baby. Say hello to all of our listeners.
I love it when you call me Big Marla. Throw your paws in the air if you's a true player. I love it when you call me Big Marla. To the bunnies getting money playing squirrels like dummies. I love it when you call me Big Marla. You got a bone up in your waist, please don't chew up the place. Why? Cause I see some fellas tonight that should be feeding me fillets. Fillets.
Alright, That's enough, Marla. Go back to licking Biggie's smalls. Anyway, here on Authentic, we talk about all things recovery. What do I mean by that, all things recovery? Well, what I mean by that is if you are still living and breathing on this earth, you, yes, you are in recovery from something. As for myself, I'm in recovery from alcoholism.
I'm an alcoholic.
I'm also a drug addict. I'm a compulsive gambler. I have an eating disorder. I have bipolar disorder. Really, the list could go on and on and on. Lucky for you, the show today is not about me. It is about two people. First is my guest, Chris, who will share his experience, strength, and hope as it pertains to what he is in recovery from. Second is the one person whose life Chris is most certainly going to save by giving his testimony today. All right, without further ado, Chris, please introduce yourself in any way you see fit, sir.
Hey, I'm Chris. Thanks for having me on the show, first of all. I'm really excited to be here, and it's really excited to have this conversation. I've known you for a while. It's been really cool.
Hell yes.
So thanks for having me. I grew up in Minneapolis. I'm 35 years old, trying to get better, trying to recover.
Chris, let us get right down to it. Why are you here?
I was really nervous about being recorded or going on a show, and I think what you said in your introduction was the most important reason to show up, is maybe someone else would listen and get some benefit out of it or learn something or at least hear someone else's experience. I just heard in a meeting right before I was invited that if you're asked to go on a rocket ship, you don't get to choose what seat you take or whatever. You just say yes and do it. And I was like, okay, I'll say yes and do it. I'm really honored to get the invitation and be here.
The feeling is mutual, Chris. Thank you so much for being on the show today. What an honor. What an honor. So thank you. Chris, you are here to talk about your recovery from alcoholism. However, there's usually some stuff, some things, some lifelike life things that lead up to using alcohol as a soother for what has happened previous to finding that false solution to our problems. What was your childhood like in relation to what was leading up to you starting drinking?
I grew up in a middle-class family that was broke. is the best way to describe it. I had the upbringing of you should go to college and do well in school, and that those things were around me, but my family was broke all the time. And so it was a little strange. We went through foreclosure, a bunch of other issues, moved around a ton. My earliest memory of my mom at home was her being sick with cancer. 6 years old, I'm at Fairview Southdale Hospital wearing a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Halloween outfit. I liked Donatello the most at the time. He was pretty cool. Visiting my mom, who was going into chemotherapy. Anyway, my memories of her are real, but she was sick and struggling and really unhappy. She got better for a little while, and then it came back with a vengeance. And she ended up passing away from it. Through that process, it was really scary. She didn't behave well and in some ways didn't die well. There's no good way to die. She was resentful and angry and paranoid. It was really bad. And so I had this sort of experience being at home with her not doing well, being sick, my dad being there. Our health insurance did not cover the experimental treatments that she wanted at the time. It was part of this HMO. So my dad paid out of pocket, went broke, when he ended up in foreclosure, barely making ends meet and stuff like that. Anyway, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
If at any time you see me like I'm about to speak, you just keep speaking. Okay. Because sometimes I get caught up in self and I'm just like, oh, I should say something funny.
I'll let you do
it's
it.
It's just like, no, you just go ahead and say what you need to say.
Okay. I'm going to stop tapping this table.
Want to ask you a question. How were you dealing with your mom's cancer, with that abnormal childhood situation? What did that look like for you? Did you have any sort of understanding of what was actually going on?
I knew she was sick, that it would probably kill her. I don't think I had an appreciation at the time. I didn't understand that meant she had a right to be afraid and to be angry at what was happening. She was 43 when she first got sick, so it's not that old, to be pissed, to not know what to do. And I don't think I really understood that. And I still have a hard time understanding that and letting her have the space to deal with things the way she dealt with it.
How did you feel about that?
I was so mad at her. I don't have the best memories of all of it. I remember her, she would pick me up from school and she was so sick that she shouldn't have been driving because of the medication she was on. But she insisted on driving anyway. And she had lost a ton of weight. She was wearing a wig because chemotherapy, you know, whatever. And I remember being so embarrassed when she would pick me up from school. God, this sucks. Why do I have to be sort of attached to this person who's not doing well? I was so angry and frustrated and wanted out. I didn't want to have to deal with that. So I was just so mad at her.
Did you have any outlets for your anger?
No. Maybe I should back up. I did, but I didn't know how to use them. What I did was mimicked my dad. And what my dad did was not talk about the fact he was going through a lot or that it might be difficult for he and I to be doing this. He just sort of tried to keep a semblance of normalcy around what was a pretty out of control situation. And so he was just stoic. He would cook breakfast every day. I was in Little League and we would just sort of power through as if everything was okay. And it wasn't. I don't think he knew how to. And I definitely didn't know how to open up the space to actually talk about what was going on and what we were going through. I take that with me to this day. In times of crisis or when things are out of control or I feel imbalanced, I pack it all inside and try to put on a strong face. And I'm way more confident cooking someone a meal than I am having a conversation about my feelings or how we're doing. That came from that period for sure.
Chris, you're not the only one. So many people that go through traumatic situations, such as your mom having cancer. I'm sorry, that is a traumatic experience, especially for a small child who can't process that and understand that your brain was still growing. Mm-hmm. And you didn't necessarily have the skills to deal with that. There's a common thread with what I hear people talk about with trauma as a young child, especially people that are chemically dependent or in recovery from chemical dependency. And that's the thread is that we don't talk about stuff. Nope, we're not going to talk about it. We're going to pretend like everything's normal. Like you said, we're going to stuff it deep inside. We're going to find a place for it, not go there. We're just going to completely ignore it. We're just going to power through. Your words, we were just going to power through. How do you wish that was different? What do you think would have been helpful to you? What were you craving at that time from your mom, your dad?
So my sister has kids. I watch how she raises her children. It's really good. And they talk through everything. And it's really cool. And I wish I had that, some sort of a place to have a real conversation about what was going on or what I was going through, what mom was going through. Like it was just kind of an unspoken dumpster fire disaster going on endlessly, you know, that just no one really talked about. And you just sort of worked around. And I wish I had that. And I didn't know how to form it. I didn't know how to talk about it with my friends. My dad did make efforts. At one time was talking to a therapist when I was in middle school, which is cool. But I didn't really know how to use that space, I think. You know, like my family, I just didn't grow up in a family where we talked about those things. I'm sure it went through the motions, but I didn't really know how to express myself or my feelings. I wish I did. I wish I was able to have a conversation with my mom on a more real basis than what I was going through.
It's interesting that generational thing that so many of us experience, especially, are you included in the millennials? Where's that cutoff?
I'm like the oldest millennial. That's my understanding of it. Yeah.
I always think, and I just see this sweeping generalization that I'm going to make, the baby boomer generation, that seems to be kind of the baseline. You don't hear too often having a childhood where we work through things, we talk about things, we use these special set of skills. And you see that in your sister and how that is completely different from what you experienced as a child. The beautiful thing, especially with folks that are in recovery, right? They're used to talking about their feelings. In order to recover and maintain recovery, we got to talk about our shit. Otherwise, it eats us alive.
Yeah.
And it makes me want to drink. If I'm not dealing with my shit, I'm going to stay stuck there. And it's going to continue to cause pain. How would you break that cycle? Do you want kids?
I don't know. Actually, I haven't had them yet and haven't. I don't think about
that it. You know of.
That I know of, that's true.
Let's play a little hypothetical here.
Yeah.
I am your 6-year-old son, and mom has cancer, and she's in the hospital. How would you explain to me what's going on? And how would you talk to me, comfort me?
How would I talk to you? I would say mom's really scared of what's going on, and it's something she has no control over. She's around doctors and taking medication, doing treatment she can't get, but that's not making her better, and what she's trying doesn't seem to be working for her. That must be really scary for you. I bet you're trying to think through a lot of feelings or anger or frustration, and that's okay. What are you going through? And let's talk about it. And that door just wasn't really open. When it was opened, I just didn't know how to use it because I didn't have that skill set to be able to have that dialogue. So I would just ask and not assume that someone bringing up their own frustrations or resentments, you have a right to be mad, angry, upset, and let's talk about that now. Because otherwise you're going to draw broader conclusions from that about how the world works, what people are like or what problems are like and how to deal with them. And that's really unhealthy, I think. I watch my sister and I watch other people raise their kids, and just asking them where they're at, giving them a lot of space to be at a place that might not be where they want to be at forever, and then help them through changing it.
Chris, as your life moved along, what was your age when your mom passed away?
So I was 10. I remember her funeral. I remember her dying. I was there. I remember her going to the hospital. She had jaundice and was yellow because her liver stopped working. So she went from home to the hospital. I remember thinking, you know, this is worse than the other time stuff like this had happened, where we had sort of carted her out of the house in the middle of the night sometimes because something was going really wrong. So I was there when she died. And I remember, and I was there at the funeral. I remember being really, really resentful that my school friend showed up, which was I just have that memory so vividly of like, why are you guys here? You shouldn't be here. They should have been there. I didn't know how to use them in a real way, support structure. So I saw them as sort of intruding. I remember being so relieved that she was gone. And I still struggle with that. It feels terrible. I felt a sense of relief. This is like finally over. And I remember thinking that at the funeral.
Chris, I'm so honored that you shared that with me. That childhood sounds terrifying, sounds unstable, scary, trying to find words to express what you can't, this anger that resides. I'm sorry you had to go through that. That's something that a young child should never have to go through, but it's a fact of life.
Yeah.
These things happen.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that you're still sitting here across from me.
I am too. Now when I think back about it, it happens all the time. People go through horrible things they shouldn't have to go through at ages they shouldn't have to do that kind of stuff. And I think the biggest, well, you said it's right. It happens. It's the way it is. Disease is disease. Or it's so easy to be gaslit by reality. I didn't have any control over what was going on. I felt like how I felt and what I did was not valid. That's not good at all. You have to kind of work through that and realize that, like, you have a right to be mad at something you can't control and something that's really terrible.
Do you remember the last thing you said to your mom before she passed?
I don't.
What do you wish you would have said? Where you're at in your life, the work that you've done, living in this sober body, living in this nourished soul. What do you wish you would have said to her?
I wish I forgave her. I never made it clear to her that, I mean, I wish I just said, like, it's okay. What she went through is scary, terrible. People shouldn't have to do that. I would have forgiven her. I treated her poorly sometimes, and I yelled at her, and I kept her out of my life, too. I fought back when I was a kid. And I think I would have forgiven her for that. Yeah, she had no control over that. She didn't want that to happen to her. She wanted to be my mom. She couldn't. And that I treated her poorly. That's how people respond to things like this, too. And it's okay. And I never had that clarity. I remember just sort of watching her die. I don't know what I said. But I wish I said something better. I'm sure she was really scared. I mean, undoubtedly.
There's this prayer that runs through my head when people talk about forgiveness.
Yeah.
Part of that prayer, a line in that prayer, is to forgive is to be forgiven. If I put that forgiveness out into the world, it comes around back to me and allows me to be forgiven. I can allow myself to forgive myself for my actions, for my words, or lack thereof. That's the beautiful thing that is really encouraged in sober living. Someone mm-hmm. that's working a program of spirituality, someone that isn't necessarily working any program, someone that's just trying to stay sober and be a better person, trying to show up in a different way. That is what's so beautiful. It's that work on self, that selflessness can be found, that forgiveness for others can be found. It comes back to me and I can be forgiven.
Yeah. Where I took that at the time was to forget is to be forgotten. And that was sort of my approach. What I understood is getting past that was not what you're talking about. It was just move on. That was bad. I absolutely agree. And it's still a danger. It's still so easy for me to do that exact thing. I'm just like, well, just forget about it. That was unpleasant. Plow forward.
Were there any other traumas that were occurring in your life at that time?
Part of using alone and doing hard drugs and staying up all night and stuff, things like how I explored my sexuality or those types of questions were like solved by the internet, which I think is really scary. You know, at the time it was like America Online was a thing. There was IAM and chats and all that, you know, that was sort of the culture. It's worse now. But anyway, I ended up in a really abusive situation because of that, where someone took advantage of that, of me just not knowing how to, in a healthy way, explore those parts of my life. So yeah, I was sexually abused. I blame myself for that. It was sort of through this internet format. I now have a better understanding that this like happens to lots of people, that there's real dangers with teenagers not having a healthy outlet to explore this stuff, and that this is common, and that like what that was crime. That was this person taking advantage of me. But at the time, I kind of blamed myself. That was bad.
Do you still blame yourself?
No. And I didn't wrap my mind around that until the second rodeo of recovery for me. That like, actually this was like, I was exploited. There's no such thing as consent when you're 12. But I honestly, it took me a long time to come to that.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing that with me. I'm honored. I feel privileged to see into you. My heart is more full because of your testimony today. Getting to know you on that level is indescribable. I can't really find the words. So all I'm going to say is thank you. At some point, Chris started drinking.
Yeah, yeah. So first I spiraled pretty bad. There was a period between my mom dying and me finding drugs and alcohol.
Your mom passed when you were 10 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you start using substances?
I got drunk at my cousin's wedding, and I can't remember how old I was, but I was probably 12 or 13. And then beyond that, I really started, and I didn't use again until I was 15.
What was that experience like, that first drunk?
Yeah, yeah, totally. So it's so funny too, because like I can't tell you the first time I ate chocolate cake. I can't tell you the first time I've done any, you know, I had pizza or anything else like that. But I can tell you about the first time I had tequila at a wedding. So from movies and culture, I knew drinking and being profound was something that people did, I guess. I remember being at the wedding and crawling behind the bar and stealing probably the cheapest bottle, the worst tequila ever, but I didn't know the difference. I don't think I knew what tequila was. I didn't make a choice. I just grabbed the bottle that my hand could get. And I grabbed a friend, and this is like, it's a good cautionary tale for what was coming. Because I grabbed a friend and we went down to a place next to a lake to hide and get drunk. And within a few minutes, my friend was not into it. And I think felt sick, and it was nasty. Tequila's nasty. It's gross. I kept going.
Why do you think that is?
When I drank, I got the feeling like, I got this. I got this under control. I know what to do with life. Things were clear to me. It was delusional, but I felt like not confused. Like I knew what to do next. And I remember thinking that way, sitting with my 12-year-old friend trying to drink tequila by a lake. I remember having clarity, like, oh, I got this. I got this under control. And that was the first time I had felt that way for a while. I was spinning out in all sorts of ways at that time in life. Basically failing every class in school. I wasn't doing any homework. I was constantly in trouble, stealing things from store. I don't know. I was just a wreck of a person.
Do you think that spin out was a direct result of your mom's passing?
I don't know. I wonder, would I still be an alcoholic if my mom hadn't been sick? I don't know. I lashed out. I had the conclusion, I remember when my mom died, and probably earlier than that, and this comes back to like some of my upbringing, like it was like a middle class house that was broke, but I still had with me the ideas that if you work hard, you get what you deserve, that there's justice and good things happen to good people and bad people happen, you know, whatever. And it totally didn't match with what was going on. And so I kind of rejected the whole thing. Nothing matters. That's not true. And there's some truth to that. Some of those ideas aren't real. See that in our world today, that bad things happen to good people all the time. Where I ran with that initially was nothing matters, totally be out of control, total isolation. I dumped all of my friends at the time. I was on a course to that. I think that was part of it. Some of it was me just acting out.
Being a teenager, you think?
Yeah, yeah.
Being a kid going through changes, puberty, those middle school years, gosh, so fucking awkward.
Yep.
For me, at least. Just, ugh. What did your continued use look like? You got drunk for the first time at your cousin's wedding at 12 or 13. What did your continued use look like with drugs and alcohol?
I liked it. I liked the experience when I was at that wedding. I didn't really know how to get it.
Did you get sick, by the way?
I did. Yeah, my aunt, she's Australian. Her and her sister made me some terrible baking soda and water weird English thing that they had learned somewhere that would like somehow help you. I remember drinking that.
It'll soak up the alcohol.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Yeah. So they made me that and sent me to bed.
Did anybody address you about?
No.
Being intoxicated at the wedding?
No.
Not your dad? Why do you think that is?
So I think they rationalized a bunch of my bad behavior too. And were just like, yeah, Chris is just kid freaking out being a kid. Yeah.
Kid being a kid.
Yeah. They didn't know about the fact that I felt for the first time like I had things under control. For most people to have a beer, get drunk at a wedding as a kid, that's like they don't find a way to approach life out of that experience, you know, but I did. I was sort of on a hunt to feel better before I found drugs and alcohol. I remember being really excited to get a job because that could get me out of the house. In a way, I did build a social network around my first job. I worked at Subway. There's a shocking amount of alcoholics and addicts who started working at Subway has been my experience, something about it. I had these conclusions about how life should work. I was sort of countercultural and rebellious. When I started working at Subway, I found people who shared those ideas in a totally unaccountable way. Most of them are older, and a lot of them had their own issues. At that time, you could smoke in the back of the store in the manager's office, and people regularly did that. I remember stealing Doral cigarettes out of the ashtray.
Mm.
Yeah, the best, huh? And I don't know how I lit them, but I wanted to start smoking. That was something adults did. When they were stressed out, they smoked. And so I wanted that. Probably rode my bike home and smoked Dorals out of the ashtray of the Subway for a while. I don't remember my first drink with them, but it was pretty quick. I remember trying marijuana for the first time at work. I'm sure I got drunk going to parties and going to people's houses after work. I would show up at parties because I couldn't go home after work, right? Because if I went home, my dad would know that I should stay at home like a normal 15-year-old should do. So I would stay out, make up some weird excuse like, oh, something terrible happened. I have to stay at the store and use that as an excuse to go out with the people after work. Got drunk. I remember getting drunk and throwing up on someone's wall, being really embarrassed about that. Most of the sort of drugs that I did at that time were in the manager's office in the back of a Subway on the clock. is not the best setting. And I had these ideas, like, I don't want to go too far with this. You know, I think I like weed, but I don't know about the other stuff. I think I tripped at work. Oh, now I like that. I remember doing my first line of cocaine. Within 6 months, that's where I was, in the back of a subway. And I do remember that, thinking, this is a really bad idea. I did it anyway, yeah.
Why did you do it anyway if you had that thought, this is none too smart, but I'm going to do it anyway?
Drugs, alcohol, using, in my mind, brought me clarity. Like, I had clarity and answers that I didn't have before. And that's the opposite of most people when they do that. But, like, it was the more I did, the more clarity I had. I now know that was totally delusional. I didn't at the time. So that became my sort of circuit. Bounced around from fast food restaurants. I stayed out of the house as much as I could, crashed at people's houses, and did whatever I could find. It was pretty bad. It got pretty bad.
What sort of consequences were you experiencing?
My dad ignored it. He didn't know how to deal with it. Yeah, he didn't know what to do. I can remember things like, so there was legal consequences and there was other consequences as well. I was pretty sloppy with my drugs and stuff. Like, I wasn't very good at stashing things or anything. So he would find things. Like, I started doing speed. He would find speed pipes in the house and sort of confront me, and I would have some sort of a really bad answer and then just get out of the situation as fast as I could. And I don't think he really knew how to pursue. I'm sure he was really worried. He was just thinking maybe this is like a phase. There were those types of consequences, or I'd stay out too late, sneaking in and out of the house. I have vivid memories. Probably the most vivid memory of the house we were living in was the route I could take up the street to get back into the house, into my bedroom, which was in a lower level, so I could sort of finagle the window without going through the front door. And that was like a pretty regular routine at like 5 a.m, you know, or whatever, trying to like creep up this road. And I knew the windows where my dad would get ready, if he looked out them, where he would see me. So I had this sort of windy path to get there behind people's shrubs and stuff like that to sneak back into the house. But I think obviously he knew what was going on. I just didn't know what to do about it. I ended up with some legal troubles. I got a DWI when I was 16, maybe 8 months after I got a driver's license. That was the first real consequence I couldn't get around. I remember that pretty well. I ended up in the Carver County Jail, got out the next day, and just went right back at it. Didn't even faze me. I don't even know how I got the car out of the impound lot. I'm not sure what the legal status of what I was doing, but I started driving again, and I got another DWI maybe 4 months later. That was worse. Between the two, I had been court ordered to go to treatment. I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had flunked out of treatment. By some magic grace of bureaucracy, me flunking out of treatment never got back to my probation officer. And so I somehow got out of probation without violating it. I can't remember. After the first DWI, they gave me something, 6 months probation. Failed the treatment, but they didn't tell the PO. And so I got out of it without them knowing that I had failed treatment. So I was off the hook and just went right back at it. Went to 3 treatment centers in between the two. Yeah, it was pretty bad.
What were your thoughts or your reaction to your exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous?
I thought it was like a networking place for me to be. So I liked it because I met people who were like me.
What do you mean, people that were like you?
I think I knew I was not like normal people, that I didn't do drugs and drink like normal people do. I would joke about it. Like, oh, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict. You know, it was almost like a point of pride or something. It was like an identity almost for me when I was 15 or 16 years old. So I think meeting people who said that was cool. It was mainly people my age. It's a lot of younger people around AA. I don't think I really paid attention to what people were talking about in the rooms or grappled with it. And I just sort of saw it as like a networking space. You know, like lots of young people, some of the people I were around were trying, but they would relapse. And then I would hang out with them, would just develop a wider network. I wasn't there for recovery, I think. But I remember feeling like, this is cool. I'm around people who are like me. I just didn't use that to get sober.
Would it be fair to say you just weren't ready yet?
Yeah. Yeah, I think
so. To quit? You weren't ready to stop doing what you were doing?
Yeah.
So many people that drink and use drugs like we do, which is abnormal. We are abnormal drinkers and drug users. It's not for recreation. We can't take it or leave it alone. We take it and we don't leave it alone.
Yeah.
What other consequences were you facing physically or emotionally?
As it got worse, I liked to use alone more and more. So that was a thing. There was this bathroom in the near my bedroom, and that bathroom was the spot for me. Totally delusional at this point. But that's what I would do. So I isolated myself more and more. I had friends who would confront me. I would show up at school drunk, get in trouble, kind of get caught with drugs at school, get in trouble. And I had friends that would confront me. I would just push them away. I didn't want to think about what they were raising. at all. Get out of my way. You don't understand. So I dumped a bunch of my friends, doubled down on finding friends that were like behaved like me, that would do the same things. I felt like I was part of a community that understood.
That sense of normalcy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I finally had kind of a tribe. It was just really destructive. You said emotionally and stuff too. I mean, some of the folks I was around were terrible, terrible people who were bullies, kind of, different sort of, you know, it's like not a very honest community if you're around a bunch of addicts, I guess, always.
Do you think they were quote unquote terrible people, or do you think they were terrible people because they were using?
The second, for sure. Absolutely.
How do you look back and view yourself? Do you think you were a quote unquote terrible person back then?
I was. But I understand why. I was ridiculous what I was doing and trying to do. And of course, I started stealing from work, lying about that, getting in trouble, getting fired, find another terrible, fast food job. I don't know, bounce around trying to find these places I get caught. I forged some checks that my dad had. That didn't go over very well for me. Luckily, that didn't lead to legal consequences. I just did not have a sense that my actions were impacting people in a very clear way.
How did your life move along?
I got caught again. I got 3 DWIs. This time I was after 18. I was 19. There was 3 years between starting and getting in trouble and sort of the final getting in trouble for me. That time I was just turned 19 years old. Got a DWI. That was like the end. I went downtown to the jail, did my 2 days. I remember thinking there's no way to get out of this one. I can't get bailed out tomorrow, that there's going to be like jail time this time. It's not just going to be like go to rehab and hopefully you figure it out, which is what the other ones were. I had a spiritual experience. Like I was like, all right, I'm done. I don't know what I'm doing. I was a wreck. Didn't have any friends, really. I just was done. I remember sort of realizing it in a jail cell, thinking I had to try something new. What I did was I actually surrendered. I didn't have a plan to get out of this. So I just went with the plan that was other people came up with, which was mainly the court system. I went to court. They gave me a year in jail. I only had to do 60 days. I did it straight through. I didn't ask my dad to bail me out. I just went for it. So I was at the downtown jail for a while. Then I got through court. I got time served. Ended up at the workhouse. After the workhouse, I went to treatment up in Anoka. That was cool. And then they said, go to a halfway house. So I went to a halfway house in Minneapolis. It was kind of an old world halfway house where they were like, get a job, do your dishes, be accountable, which was really important for me to be a person, because I was terrible when I was a teenager. I didn't do any of that. I was not a participant in our household in any way whatsoever. And so those things were really amazing. I got a job at a grocery store. I finally saw Alcoholics Anonymous as a way to become a person. And that was really important because I really didn't know how to do that.
Do you think that your emotional and mental growth was stunted there?
Absolutely. Yeah. For me, I would say even before that, I would put it at my mom's death. Like, I think I turned 11 when I turned 20 in a halfway house in South Minneapolis. You know what I mean? That was when I actually sort of started feeling and being accountable and being responsible, forming real friendships. It was a real blossoming for me. Absolutely. Like, that also with drugs and alcohol when I was a teenager, stunted it more or depressed that even further, I guess.
Pushing down things even further. We will be right back. We are going to talk about how Chris got some help!
Yeah.
Help me! Let's get Chris some help. We will be right back.
Security and mall expansion. Whatever I wear, know I'm here to be clashing.
Oh yeah.
to Authentic. Yay! We're here in Studio 3 at KFAI with Chris. He's drinking tea. Welcome back to Authentic. We are here with Chris. Chris, let's get into some help. When did you first get help that you wanted for your alcoholism? When did you actually want help and receive it?
It was after I got in a bunch of trouble. 3 DWIs, 19 years old. I'm in the Hennepin County Workhouse for 60 days with a year hanging over my head. I was around people who were in there I could relate to. Like, it was sort of party dogs or people, you know, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, we would talk about that kind of stuff. But they were twice my age, in there longer, and had a whole bunch of wreckage in their life. And I remember thinking, I don't want that. I don't want that. I keep getting in trouble. I don't know how to stop getting in trouble. I remember realizing that it was my fault, which was a big deal. When I got in trouble in the past, it was because I got caught. I did something wrong. The third time around, I had a plausible excuse. Like, I was going to be okay. The problem wasn't that I was driving around high on cocaine and drunk. The problem was I ran out of gas, and so they got me on the side of the road. And I remember that melting away and me being like, you know, if I hadn't been messed up, I wouldn't have gotten in trouble. You just ran out of gas, you get gas, put it in your car. And that was kind of crushing. And so I actually surrendered to the best of my ability. I'm going to do whatever they say. I have no idea how to get out of this. I have no plan. Did the workhouse, got out, immediately got trucked up to Anoka. Truck back down to Halfway House after that, then Sober House after that in South Minneapolis. I was open. Like, I look back now, and I think there were some weaknesses. At the time, I was a blank slate. Whatever you guys want to do, I'll do.
That's such an interesting perspective for someone that has gone through that, to not resist, to not accept that help, to not believe in that situation that, whoa, my life is super fucked up. I don't want any help, though. I can do this by myself. All I need to do is stop drinking and using drugs. That's it. That's what the crux of the problem is that I'm drinking and using drugs. So if I stop that, I don't need anybody else's help. I can do this. And it's so amazing that you had a complete opposite reaction to your situation. You said you surrendered. You said that I will do what you want me to do. What sort of support were you getting from your dad when all of this was happening?
So he was really excited. And I think he knew that this time around was different. I'd gone through treatments, failed out. I had gone through probation, failed out. You know, I'd done that. He had seen that happen, gotten in trouble. And I think he had a sense that this was new and exciting, that I wasn't resisting the plans that were being put in front of me, which at that time were not very elaborate. You're going to go to this treatment center in Anoka, be there, do it. And I was, okay, I'll go. And
do
I,
you think that your dad's perception of you was influenced more by your actions or by the words you spoke to him?
By my actions, for sure. I didn't have a contingency or an amendment to the process. Okay, yeah, I'll do this. And I think that was convincing to him quickly, actually. He was supportive really quickly.
You said you went to a halfway house after you left the workhouse. What was helpful about living in this sober house? And what did that situation look like?
So it was like a renaissance of me becoming a person that I didn't really figure out. I think when most people in their like teenage years sort of learn that, they learn that through struggle and making mistakes. I like just didn't get it until a little later. So yeah, I got to the halfway house. So in the treatment center, actually, it was unique because the treatment center didn't have a communal kitchen. So they would send us down to Aldi with like $50 and we'd have to cook at home and then do this stuff. And that was cool. I kind of like cooking. I learned how to cook. I still like cooking a lot. The halfway house was more of that. You know, it was a 12-step program, but it was kind of old world in a way where they said, you know, if I remember right, it was within 48 hours you had to have a job interview. This is 2004.
Within 2 days of being at the sober house, you had
so.
To have an interview?
Or you had to have a long list of applications that didn't turn you down. I mean, you had to hit the ground running. Go get work. Find a 40-hour-a-week job. I remember that being a big deal.
What do you think would have happened if the approach was softer, where they gave you more time, were more passive?
I desperately needed some structure, and I thrived in it. And I don't know if I would have had that. If I would have had more time just to, I mean, I had a lot to talk about and a lot to say, but if people would have just let me stay there, I sort of knew the ropes of how to talk about AA a little because I'd been in meetings in the past. I'd been through treatments, and I could sort of put on a show. about in a group session enough to get a enough for me to think I got a counselor off my back, which wasn't actually true. So for them to confront me with like, okay, welcome, go to your job applications and you're going to take whatever you can get that's 40 hours a week. I remember that was pretty shocking. You know, like, oh, I have to do it or I don't. And I did. I got a job at a grocery store. I made those sandwiches that they no longer make in the stores. They bring them in, but at the time they made them in the store. So my job every day was to get to work at 6 a.m. and make like 400 or 500 turkey, tuna, roast beef sandwiches and put them out onto the thing. And I remember just pleading with the manager to hire me on because I didn't want this. I thought he was harsh man at the halfway house who was running it to be mad at me. And so I remember sort of negotiating, I'll do whatever it takes. I got to get a job. This guy's going to get me. I have a criminal record. I'm in a halfway house, full disclosure. I'm trying to get sober. At that time, maybe I had 3 or 4 months.
The beautiful thing and the amazing thing, the rawness, the impressive thing about folks in early sobriety, I was so raw and so honest. It's, hey, I've been sober. I don't even know this person. And they might like think I'm a crazy fucking drunk drug addict. But I'm going to tell this person everything. And maybe, just maybe, if they hear the honesty that's pouring out of me, they'll give me a job. Here's this guy that's going to be an honest worker. He's had a troubled past. Everybody likes a rebound. Everybody likes a second chance story.
You brought that up and it's funny. I think I called my dad when I was first in the halfway house being like, man, they want me to, how am I going to do this? They're going to kick me out of here and then I'm going to go back to jail because I'm on probation and I got to do whatever they say. And so he told me how to get a job in a real way, which was like, you have to go bother the manager and make it clear you want. Anyway, so that's what I did. I was sort of hounding down this manager. I found her name from somebody else that worked there. And sort of like, I remember going back probably 3 times a day the first day trying to catch her shift or something. I had to do this personality test where they asked you, I don't think they do them anymore. Maybe they still do, but I failed it. And I don't remember what I did, but I remember she said, we can't, you know, Chris, you sound like a nice enough guy. We want to hire you, but you need to go do this personality test again. And by the way, don't be totally honest. Like they asked some question like, is it ever ethical to steal food or something? And I said, yes. And that booted me off the list in their sort of database that they have, you know, so it rejected me. So I had to go do it again. I remember her saying, you got to try again. So anyway, that's how raw I was that I bombed their test and had to tell me to go get the job.
I love those subtle nuances of people's journeys in recovery. Those little stories ignite something, put a fire under my ass. Because you've been bucked by this bronco called addiction, you've been to a few rodeos. How were you helping these guys in your sober house? How were you helping them? Because you had a history, because you had surrendered, because you had these seeds planted, these skills laying in front of you. How were you helping these other guys that you were living with?
Not as much as I should have. I mean, we had a really strong sense of community and it was cool. Like we would, you know, you'd go as a pack to the AA meeting and come home and you could hang outside of the house and smoke cigarettes. I remember making really good friends with when I was there. I regret not playing more of an active role beyond that with people's recovery.
What kind of role do you wish you had played?
I think when you're around a lot of people trying to get sober, you start to see the signs of someone drifting away or having trouble, and intervening can be really good. And intervening doesn't need to be, don't do this. I've noticed this change in behavior. And I don't think I really knew how to do that. And so I would just watch people drift away sometimes. And then they'd go back out. The halfway house was like, you're gone. They would boot you. And I remember thinking like, man, I kind of saw that coming. And I wonder if I could have done anything about it. And I didn't really know how. I think that's like, this is part of the childhood stuff, is I didn't really know how to intervene when you see warning signs or patterns in behavior that are different, which are really apparent to other people, not to yourself always. And I saw those and I didn't dig in and fight for people, I think, as much as I should have. And of course, it's their life. And they make their own choices. You know, I just watched it.
What you said right there just saved a life. Someone listening to your episode that's in a halfway house that doesn't reach out to people sees the same things that you have seen where somebody is struggling and they don't have the courage, they don't find the opportunity to reach out to this person and say, hey, your demeanor has changed. You seem more distant. You've been isolating. Like, do you want to go do something or is everything okay? You just saved a life by saying that because it gives somebody that just that little push in the right direction. That's what he didn't do and wishes he had done.
Yeah.
So maybe, just maybe, I'll do that.
I hope so.
And I know so.
I was afraid that because I didn't fully understand what was going on with somebody else, it was like their business and I wasn't courageous enough. Hey, I've just noticed these things. You tell me what's going on. I didn't know how to do that. So I thought it was imposing.
You got sober in 2004.
Yeah.
How long did you stay sober?
So I was sober over 9 years and a lot of good things happened in my life. I was in the 12 steps. I did AA. I did the steps. I prayed with a guy holding hands. He was like really old school world. So it was like you did the third step prayer where you ask your higher power to take over. I did it in his basement holding hands with him. It was wild. And then you like read the book, you know, here it is, go. I kept that job for a long time, which was a huge victory. I solved a lot of problems.
Why was that such a big victory to keep that job?
Well, just be committed to something and be consistent, follow through with things, show up every day. Show up at 6:30. I remember walking to work. I got a coffee at the Super America on Lake and Bryant. There used to be a gas station there. Now it's a condo. I'd get a coffee. Then I'd walk to work. I was sort of late. I'd burn my hand every day, get in there. I mean, it was that type of structure was crucial for me. Those little things were essential. I stayed there. I stayed in the neighborhood. Eventually got tired of working at the grocery store and went to school. Did really well. I did a homework assignment for the first time in a decade. I made it out of high school, but it barely counted, honestly. I think I just got a diploma for them just to like let me go. So I went to MCTC. I had tons of remedial classes. That was embarrassing. Like I wasn't even in algebra. Like I was in like basic algebra, you know, like I was so bad, you know, that I, you know, and I had to pay for it. I paid cash.
Solve for X. One X equals two.
No idea. I had no idea. And I wrote it was so cool. I learned a ton and it was because I was sober and because I was making an effort. And I just didn't learn how to do things. I couldn't learn how to write a paper and learn what a period, where to use a comma. I didn't get any of that.
Did you develop a community, a support system while you were in school with your classmates?
Not as much as I should have. I developed a community, but I wish it was deeper and I regret that. I'm not in touch with my classmates who are there, even though I loved them at the time. And it was so fun. And MCTC is such a beautiful place. It was like the first time I had really, in a meaningful way, been exposed to, I was just infatuated with the place. Like, this is the coolest place I've ever been, you know, that there's different people with different backgrounds. We're all trying to get through this English class or whatever it was. Anyway, I didn't develop the best community I should have. And I regret that still.
There's a pattern with you, Chris.
Yeah, yeah.
You say should have a lot.
I know. Now I would do it differently.
Someone once told me, don't should on yourself.
Yeah, that's real.
Because shoulding on yourself, in my experience, shames. It's self-shaming. And the way that I've repackaged that is by sharing my experience, saying, I didn't have those skills back then. But this I can help you with because I now have this clear knowledge of myself and how I wanted to show up. Here's how I wanted to show up. Here's some suggestions. And that's why you went through that.
Yeah.
That's why you went through that. That's why you're shooting on yourself. Because you're meant to help someone. So someone doesn't have to go that same way. Someone doesn't have to follow the same path that you followed, which you wish was different. I wish I would have done this differently. And instead of that negativity, that negative connotation to that statement, we can flip it on its ass and say, I've been through that. Try this. I really wish I would have tried this, and I didn't. Maybe this will work for you. That reframing has been so helpful for me. You stayed sober for 9 years.
I did, and became a person.
I remember when I was 9 days. I don't remember when I was nine hours sober. I was shit-faced in detox.
Yep.
It's another story for another day. When I had 9 days of sobriety, if I looked at you and you said, I have 9 years of sobriety, I would have been terrified. How the hell did he do that? By the same token, I would look at you, and if you shared what you've shared with me today about how you've done it, how you've stayed sober, what has transpired, these promises of a program that tell you if you do this thing, if you take action, your life will get better. Especially when one alcoholic, one addict shares that with another one, because we can resonate with each other, because we share the same story.
Right.
We share that common peril. When you share that, that gives me the hope that if he can do it, I can do it too. I'm someone That's 9 days sober, and I want to know how you've done it. How have you stayed 9 years sober? I want to do that too.
I did whatever people said. I surrendered. You have a suggestion from people who are around AA or people who've gotten better, who had my experience and were doing better things. Just like, do it. Just do it. Do the steps. I read the book and the promises worked. The big advice I would give is that I didn't know how to be of service to other alcoholics in a real way. And I had some, I made it through the steps and tried to sponsor people. And I think I made it too formal, I think, you know, like, oh, this person didn't want to go through the book with me. And I tried it like 3 or 4 times and sort of gave up on the whole idea of it. And I didn't realize that there's so many small things you can do even when you have 9 days. Like, even when you have 9 days, even sharing your story keeps people sober. When that happens in the rooms I'm in, those are the best shares, you know, because it's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. And it's not just what people say. It's how they are when they first come in. And I remember being that way. I just remember being shaky and feeling weird and awkward. And even just that is a contribution to the meeting for me. So I don't know. That'd be my advice, you know. I overthought that. And just thought, like, sponsorship was, like, kind of therapy. You know, like, I had to be some sort of Jedi master and have really insightful things, and people rejected it.
What is sponsorship?
Well, now I think I have a broader definition of it. To me, it's about we all have this shared experience, even though we all have really different lives. But there's, like, there's an essence of the experience that's really similar that we can relate to each other. That's the key to helping other people stay sober and also helping yourself stay sober. The other side of it is, like, it's not just sharing experience. Like you were saying earlier, thankfully, that experience has been generalized out into a set of steps and a book or multiple books. You don't need to just bang your head against the wall on every strange corner, because other people have gone through that and they have some tools you can use.
Speaking of tools.
Yeah.
Beyond the 12 steps, so many people that are in recovery or are thinking about getting sober or clean, mental health issues need to be addressed.
Yeah.
In order for this to be an all-encompassing, honest sort of submission, this recovery process requires me to be honest about everything. And that includes my mental health.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was my bipolar. Had these manic episodes followed by extreme depression. How did you address your mental health in sobriety?
I'm still trying to address that. I have a fear of sort of, it's not that I don't believe in it or don't see.
What do you mean? Don't believe in what?
I am hesitant about doctors and medicine.
Why do you think that is?
It's from my childhood. I just don't like hospitals and I don't like pills. I remember a memory of my mother is the Monday through Friday pill box thing. She had an extra large one because the amount of stuff that she was trying to do to keep her body going, you know, that kind of, I don't like any of it.
Do you think that maybe if you go to a hospital, if you visit with nurses and doctors, you could somehow transform your relationship with medicine?
Yeah.
Going in and instead of having that resentment, that fear of that past experience, maybe something else needs to happen where you just have an honest, heartfelt conversation with a nurse, get to know them, mm-hmm. and change that perspective. Pull the trigger and go to the doctor, go talk to a psychiatrist, and just be honest about where you're at. I don't like being here. I don't like hospitals,
right?
Because of my childhood and my mom having cancer and my relationship with hospitals. Can you help me?
That is what I need to do.
I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just suggesting, because that's happened for me. I was terrified going to the dentist, going to the hospital, because I always thought not only was there something wrong with me mentally, emotionally, physically, but I didn't want anybody to verify that.
Yeah.
That's what I was so afraid of. My worst fears coming to fruition, which rarely happened. Sometimes it did, but it usually didn't. Catastrophizing in my head. When I developed relationships with nurses, that changed my whole perspective on the whole medical community, whether it's dentists, medical doctor, psychiatrist, anything like that. And it's all really due to two people. First is my former girlfriend who saved my life. She could have broken up with me so many times, and she said, Nick, this is after I got sober, she said, Nick, I wanted to break up with you so many times, but I knew if I did, you were going to die. The last couple years of our relationship, she was going to nursing school and I was drinking myself to death, using drugs, using alcohol, to end it. It was that slow suicide. And she stayed with me. And I attribute so much of that support from her, so much love for me, so much compassion for me, even though it wasn't overtly expressed, that was directly related to her advocating for patients, her work as a nurse, her personality thriving in that realm. Nurses saved my life on multiple occasions. My first sponsor, who I've gotten back in contact with, and now he's my sponsor again, he's a PACU nurse. Every time I go to the doctor, I develop relationships with the nurses. That's my purpose. One of my purposes, one of my purpi, if you will, in life is to develop those relationships. Long story short, maybe something that you could do too.
Yeah, I agree.
You stayed sober for 9 years and then you relapsed.
I went back out.
You went back out. Why after 9 years? What happened? What transpired? What led up to that relapse?
Part of the 9 years was me making really big gains about my understanding of life, about my understanding of the world, about what I wanted to do in it. Kind of deeply held belief that, like, the only constant in history is change. That's the only thing you can count on, you know, is things change and evolve, and that people can be a part of that. It's not just change and for change's sake, it's change in a direction, and we can have a role there. And I developed, you know, I still believe that. Where I took that at the time was to apply that to my own alcoholism. I can't be the same person I was when I was hiding in my downstairs bathroom doing drugs. You know, I'm different. Everything's different. That didn't lead me to using. That idea crept in and was real. I relapsed. I didn't see it coming. And I relapsed at like a high moment. I was on a vacation in another country. It was the second time I had ever left the country. Exciting, cool place. Part of where I was at like this festival, and I was pretty infatuated with the whole thing. What is everyone else doing at the festival, and how do I participate in this festival? I should have some beer. So I did. And it was not like the first time I drank, I ended up in a jail in Belgium that night. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, bam, here I am, you know, right back to where, I mean, the truth is it was different than when I was 19. The form of my addiction was different, but the essence of it ended up being the same. But it was different. I didn't just go straight back to hard drugs hiding in a bathroom. But I had a great time. Got that feeling back of, I got this. I know what to do. I have control that this is making me better, stronger, more thoughtful, sharper of a person. I had a relatively fun night. My original justification, and my partner, who knew I'd been sober 9 years and didn't understand how dangerous it was for me to drink. It was like, oh yeah, this is just a one-off thing. I had a great night. I wanted to make it better. And the original thing was, this is like once every 5 years. When I'm in a really special situation, I'll do it. And I peeled those rules back as I just started using more and more and more. And so it became, I only drink at parties. That didn't work, because to be social at a party and drink the way I wanted to drink, there's a contradiction there. So I started doing things like, I would go to a party where there was social drinking, like a kegger, where there's a nice keg. And it wasn't like a kegger when I was 19. It was a kegger, like adult kegger, where there is a keg of beer and people are actually being people around the beer. I had some pressure to be a part of that. So I would do things like, I would fill up a glass of beer or two for a fake person who I was going to give a beer to across the yard, and slam down the one and then responsibly drink the other one that was in my hand, and do ridiculous things like that. And slowly I just peeled away all those rules until I was back in a place of drinking alone, terrified, in a lot of trouble. And so, yeah, I it was a slow march. It took a couple of years for me to fully get back to a similar place than where I was the first time around. And thank God it wasn't the same legally as the first time. It could have been a lot worse.
Where were you at when you came back to recovery? Why'd you come back? Where were you?
Okay, so there's kind of two parts of it. One was, I was probably drinking heavily every other day. At that time, was very good at hiding beer. So every other night I went to bed near blackout drunk. And I woke up feeling terrible. And then there were these terrible, it's like almost this haunting, like the raven and the heart in the floor type thing. For me, I started, my face would get all puffy. So I had these like puffy eyes. I remember hating that, but I just vividly remember that, amongst other things that were starting to happen. And so I was blackout drunk every other night. I would use the other day to recover. I'd sort of have a half day of recovering and then sort of try to do some work and then go to bed early. Then there would be these windows where I would go all out, and that was really scary. And then there were these instances of full blackout, doing something really dangerous. But it wasn't a consistent thing. It's like a weekly thing, which I could accept. You know, there were some really big warning signs. Like I went on a trip and...
Did you no longer think that you were an alcoholic?
No, I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew at a certain point along that road, I was wrong. I hadn't changed.
I knew. Yet you did it anyway. Why?
I didn't know how to stop. And I was back to the place where I knew on one level I had 9 years, and 9 days was, I couldn't conceive it anymore. It's like, I'm gonna drink again.
There's that idea there that it's possible, though.
Yeah. 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 I didn't
Do you think in part that that knowledge about yourself played a role in saving your life?
Absolutely.
That knowledge that there's a community there. There's people that understand me. There's people that will welcome me back with open arms, no matter what I've done.
Yeah.
As long as I have the desire to be a sober person, I am welcome back with open arms. We don't shoot our wounded. We have that spiritual, mental, physical, emotional sickness, a disease. It doesn't matter what I call it. It's a thing, and it's a real thing. It exists.
Yeah.
It's a fact. Addiction is real.
It's real, and it's not just about using. Everyone says this. You know, it's not just about using, right? Like, part of why it was so hard was, as I made these concessions, I'm not going to drink alone, and then I'm drunk alone. I'm not going to do this, and then I did this. As that happened, the way I responded to it was to peel away all of the sort of pressures that were on me, that were keeping me sober or keeping me in check to some, I would just peel them away. Peel them away. I mean, I think that's part of the addiction, is it's like, it's not just you, but you create your own environment for that addiction to flourish. And I was really good at that. You know, I was flaky. If people wanted to meet me somewhere, I would never commit to that. I didn't want to sign up for something because I didn't know if that would be the night where I would have an opportunity to get full bore, blackout, crazy drunk, you know, or whatever. I started not hanging out with friends. If I did, it was sort of spontaneous. I was pre-gaming before and afterwards. My partner and I were fighting. I wasn't honest with anyone around me. And so I pushed them away. When people did call me out, I cut them off and I created a little environment for me.
You were right back where you were.
Yeah. I mean, the essence
is
the same.
Just in a different location.
Yeah.
Just in a different geographical location. You were right back where you were 10, 12 years before.
There's that saying of like, you end up where you started, but know the place for the first time, you know? And that was kind of it. Like, it was different, right? Like, I was there and it was different at the same time, but it was also there were parts of it that were really the same.
My dad, who's a substance abuse professional, a therapist, and saves lives on a daily basis, mm-hmm. doing what he does, he always tells his patients, and he tells me, he says, Nick, sobriety, working a program, finding your spirituality, staying sober, doing the work, it's the hardest work you will ever do.
Yeah.
It's simple, but it's not easy. It's the hardest work you're ever going to have to do, and it's the most rewarding thing you will ever do. The best thing that you will ever do is getting sober, staying sober, and finding a purpose. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to talk about my favorite four-letter word. Hope. Hope. We'll be right back.
My tongue. like prisons over gates before the Dobermans come. I was born double-fisted, but I'm holding in one. And when I take a shot, it burns like a smoldering sun. And then there's alcohol to bane, ethanol to brain. This moment is a gift without the tinted cellophane. I don't need no soda mixer, just give me the cold elixir. Hustlers know that hunger is just murder. Sex, the oldest is the vocalist, the orator. Duck and clear the corridor. Some drink it neat, like the jacket on a corner. I go wait, my best friend is Dora the Explorer. That line was dope, I had to smuggle it to Florida. Arriba, Abajo, Acentro, Adentro. If they don't open up the gate, we all gon' go mental. Bottoms up, until we all are free. And there'll be some for the homies and some for me.
There's a monsoon in Alaska. There's a monster under my skin. There's a street brawl under my skin.
Welcome back to Authentic! Yay! Chris is still here. We haven't scared him away. Yay, Chris. Thank you so much, Chris, for sharing today. Your honesty, transparency is invaluable to me, to everyone that's going to hear this. Truly beautiful. So thank you. Let's talk about my favorite four-letter word, hope. Chris, what are you doing to further and nourish your sobriety?
After the relapse, I wandered in. I knew where to go, saved my life, made things, it reduced harm for sure to know that I could just go find an AA meeting. I know where to wander in. I did that. I remember being really annoyed that I had missed the morning meetings on the Saturday and had to wait till 5. So I wandered into a meeting in Northeast Minneapolis at 5, but I had to wait a whole 6 hours or something to be able to do that. First time coming back. After 9 years and then going back out, I viewed AA and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as a tool for me to get what I wanted. I think that's kind of how I was approaching it. Like, I can finally win. You know, I'm losing. I'm unhappy. Everyone's mad at me.
What did you really want?
I think I wanted to stop getting in trouble. I wanted to stop being in pain. I wanted to stop feeling terrible. I wanted to stop being regretful of what I'd done. I think I thought AA would help me with that. And I didn't want to go much further than that. So I thought AA was like a tool to finally get my way.
What would you suggest to someone that doesn't feel AA is for them? Because that's not the only way to stay sober, to be happy, to help others, to maintain a good life.
Yeah.
A fulfilling life. What would you say to someone that AA is not for me? What do I do?
I think the point of AA is to be searching and working towards getting better and being of service. That's the idea of it. And I think whatever path people choose to do that, the important thing is that you're doing that. And if you try something and it doesn't work, try something else. Just don't stop trying something, to me, is the key thing. And I think that's real. I have moments, too, where I have doubts about parts of the program. I have doubts, you know, and I have that. And what I hope is that if I find something better, that I'm courageous enough to do that then and do it as energetically and actively as I need to and don't just use it as an excuse to go back to my plan. Because I really don't have a great idea of how to get out of the hole that I dig. So that's what I would say. And be energetic and active. Try new things.
Chris, you are in recovery from a great many things.
Yeah.
Just like everyone else, because you are still living and breathing, which means to some degree, in all your experiences, all your traumas, you are in recovery, whether you like it or not. What does your recovery look like now in regard to losing your mom?
From that experience, I have a deep feeling, I have a fear that commitment to other people is bad because they'll fail you. That it's vivid in the way that I interact with people or the way that I try and have a hard time forming friendships or forming a meaningful relationship with my partner, my family. I carry that with me. And so for me, it is recovering from that is being present for people, showing up at a friend's birthday party and actually engaging with them, for trying to not just talk to my friends or talk to my partner or talk to my family, but to consciously open up the space to form a real relationship with them and be present in that. That's a terrifying thing. I really don't like it, but I know I need to.
What do you want to say to your mom right now?
Mm.
What do you want to tell her?
I don't know. I've never thought about that, I guess. I would tell her that what happened is okay, that I'm still a member of a family and that I'm still loved. That's what she wanted and couldn't do it, or couldn't do it very well, but she tried her best. And I think telling her that, like it's all good, I have that. That'd be a big thing, I think, for her to hear.
Do you mind if we try an exercise?
Yeah, or I don't mind, sorry.
I have somehow been transformed into your mom in this human body. I'm no longer Nick. I am your mom. What's your mom's name?
Gracie.
Gracie. Gracie's here looking into your eyes. Chris, what do you want to say to me?
I would say, what do I want to say? I've looked right into your eyes and do it.
Yep, you got to look at me.
Yeah, you were kind of out of control. Said some stuff and did some stuff that I think was bad. And I understand why, but I think it was bad. And I responded poorly too. I want you to know that I do have people around me who can support me, and I found that. I have been able to find that community, find that family, and feel loved and valued, which I believe you were trying to do, even though you were sick.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
What does your recovery look like in regards to your sexual assault?
I don't know yet. That's been new. It was part of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that one of the steps is you make a list of resentments and things that happened, the wreckage of the past. The first time around, I didn't bring that up because I kind of blamed myself. I did blame myself. So the second time around, I did.
What would you say to someone that has been sexually assaulted that is afraid to bring it up, that hasn't brought it up because they are fearful, embarrassed, shamed? What would you say to that person?
That you didn't do anything wrong. You're not alone. Unfortunately, this happens way, way too often, and it's really horrible and terrible. That it's important to be able to share that and connect with other people. And I think that would be part of recovering, but it's still pretty new and pretty fresh and raw. And just to get to the idea that that was a wrong. I didn't do anything wrong. A really terrible thing that happened, that took years. And it took a program, some variety to get there for me. Like, I didn't know what to do with it. I remembered and I had a sense that it wasn't great, but I didn't know where to put that or how to even approach it on my own.
Who do you suggest that person talk to about their trauma? What do you think would have been helpful for you? Who do you think would have been helpful for you to trust, to tell?
I mean, I should have told my dad. That was the go-to point at that time. I didn't know what I was doing or I was young. Just like telling my dad that this happened. And I think he could have helped a ton, and I just didn't. So he didn't know how to help. Just telling anyone can be the first step, I think. It's really key. Someone you're comfortable with, and then figuring out what you want to do with it, which I still don't have the best answer for that part of it, but I'm trying.
How do you feel now that you're talking about that trauma?
So even on this podcast, on the show, I didn't think I was going to bring it up when I first showed up, because it's I haven't even been fully clear with folks who are close to me about it. I think every time you are willing to share your experience, it stops being a weakness and can become a strength, and you feel just more comfortable and clear. You know, it's like the world doesn't stop turning. Everything doesn't fall apart. I think that's what I think about sometimes when I think about it. If I talk to people about it, like, my world will literally collapse, or I'll light on fire or something. You know, I have these ridiculous fears about it. And so just uttering the words or saying it or just being honest takes that away, because the world doesn't stop turning. I don't light on fire, and it's okay. And it is okay.
Why did you tell me?
I don't think I'm part of the solution to something like that if I don't tell that story. And I think I have a hard time figuring out how and where to tell it. And that's still really difficult for me. It doesn't seem to be helpful to not either. So I'll do it in a clumsy way, you know, but that's okay.
It is okay.
Yeah.
I want to say thank you again for sharing that with me. Whether or not that makes it to the release version of this podcast episode, just you sharing that with me, thank you.
You're welcome. And thanks for creating the space to do that. Because had I not been consciously trying to get better, and had I not been around people who are also trying to get better, I don't have the room to take a risk or to do something like that. Certainly when I was drinking, I didn't create any space for that. I made things worse. I remember just the first time I told someone about it, I was doing my fourth step. And I said, be rigorous and honest. So I did it and I wrote it down. And I almost, it was like a apostrophe on the rest of it. Oh, by the way, this happened too, you know. I think that at the time, the person I was working on that with, of like doing a real inventory of what had happened in my life, was like, that sounds really important. I was like, yeah, it's probably really important, but like, that's as far as I want to go. That was a big step, just being like, mm-hmm. this occurred was terrifying. And then how to think about it and how to talk about it and how to get better from it is, you can't get to that if you don't just say it and no one knows what's going on with you.
There are so many people that find their only way out, their only way to relieve their pain from traumas, active addiction, loss, grief. Those people, unfortunately, think that the only way to end that pain, to solve that, is to end their life. Why didn't you?
There's this part in the AA Big Book where they talk about people committing suicide and that the person being not brave enough or something to follow that route, and they went to get drunk. I think some of it was that I did not value my life when I was using, and I did a lot of stupid things, and bad things happened to me, and I did bad things. And if it was sort of part of the circumstances of actively using, I could sort of write it off as like, well, that's just sort of by chance. So I did many things that were put my life in danger, and I justified those things by saying like, this just kind of comes with the territory of being blackout drunk and almost falling asleep on a railroad tracks or doing things like that. I don't know. And how I never, and thank God that that didn't happen. And I had friends sometimes who, even though I was drinking with them, pull me up and bring me home or do that type of, I was a mess. I think, I don't know. Yeah, I guess that's what I have.
As a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I would like to reiterate that the only requirement to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is an honest desire to stop drinking. Part of a large part, a core part of 12-step programs is developing spirituality and that seeking spirituality. And in the book, they talk about this thing called a higher power that they choose to call God. You can call it whatever you want, but they also mention the term higher power. What does your spirituality consist of? What does your higher power look like? Does it have a name? What does your spirituality look like?
That was the biggest barrier for me. Coming back, I have to confront this or think about it. And more importantly, not think about it, figure out how this is going to help me stay sober. Your higher power can be one thing or the other thing. It's different things to all sorts of people. They call it different things. But it has to sort of function a certain way. It has to be a tool to help you be of service, to get better, to clear away the bad stuff that happened in the past and to stop creating bad things so you don't need to clear it away as often, you know? I was really, really resistant to it.
Why?
Some of it was my mom and religion. And it wasn't like I was mad at religion itself as much as I was mad at the way she grasped for something that I thought wasn't real. This is crap. You know, like my mom was a Catholic and she had vials of holy water and shrouds of cloth that came from someone's tunic, you know, all this stuff that was going to help her. I just thought it was crap. Like, there's nothing's going to help you. Some of it's lumping it in with that. Like, that's a weakness. And some of it is I just have a hard time with it. There's this part in the book where they talk about, like, haven't you ever looked up at a sparkling night sky and wondered who made this? And, I mean, of course I wonder who made this. But I also wonder, like, isn't Twinkling Night's Eye nice enough? You know, like, do you need more? Does it need to be created? And does the thing that created it think about me on a daily basis and worry about whether or not I'm being a good person? Those are real barriers for me. I still am not sure about that part of it. Is my higher power like a conscious thing?
Do you have a chosen name for your higher power?
I don't. Sometimes, so a joke I have is I call it the committee, which is like...
I love it.
Yeah. I can like run it by the committee. You know, like I'm thinking about doing something really... Usually I have some plan that's not very good to deal with something or to get myself out of some scrape that I'm in. And my plan's not that great. And I kind of know it's not that great. Like, it's not a great plan. So I can run it by the committee. I'm going to run this by the committee. I'll talk to someone in AA, or I'll talk to 8 people who I trust and my sister or something like that through some sort of a process of me accepting that I don't have a great plan for this thing that's happening or my life generally.
In this acceptance of the plan...
Yeah.
That you run by the committee and see what they what they recommend.
Yeah.
What are their official recommendations for your scrapes?
Oh man. Yeah, usually it's like I should be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I should not act out of a place of fear that the world's not about me.
Right. Well, now that you're in that place,
yeah,
where you have that, you're seeking that, and you're beginning to nourish that, feed that committee so that they can be strong to help you. So you have something to rely on, something to lean on. This ambiguous thing that cannot be explained, mm-hmm. or tries to be explained, but can never know. Because you have developed that spirituality, do you still believe, do you still think that your mom is weak because of her reliance upon her Catholicism?
No.
Why not?
I mean, I know what it's like to be in such a desperate place that I had no idea what to do. And I was gonna try anything to get better, and that's still sort of how I operate. Like, I'm willing to try something because I don't really have a great idea of how to do stuff, how to get better, how to make things okay, or how to feel okay. And for her to, when I think about it that way, that it wasn't like sort of snake oil, you know, like this holy water that she had or something. When I think of it as like, this was a form of her looking for help. And, you know, I'm not to criticize that form of it, you know, that much, even though if I have my doubts whether or not the holy water helped her. For her, it was part of reaching out, and it was part of trying to get better. And nothing was working. And like, bless her soul for trying every tool. Like, what's the alternative, right? That I feel like she shouldn't have tried that tool. That doesn't work, or doesn't sit right with me. So good. Good for her for doing it. I don't think it was weak.
Chris, are you afraid to die?
No.
Why?
I mean, I don't want to die. I'm not afraid to die. I don't believe in the afterlife. I believe that death is death. It's like I'm not going to worry about it afterwards. It's just what it is. I have my time here, and when I die, that time's over. And I kind of understand on one level, like I have energy, and I'm made up of atoms, and they go places, and I get that. But like the collection of particles and energy that is functioning right now, which I call Chris, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. And I'm okay with that. Or I'm more, maybe the right way to say it is, I'm more okay with that than the idea that like that goes on forever, you know?
It is a bit unsettling.
Yeah.
To think that it's going to be forever.
Yeah.
Forever is a terrifying word.
Forever's forever. But I don't know. I mean, it to me, the benefit of what I get out of that, though, and not being afraid or worrying about it that much, is like, then it's all in the now. Like, you just have to do the best you can with every single thing. There's no second chance. There's no, you can, it's true. You walk out the door and get hit by a bus, you know, and so you just have to squeeze everything out of what's here now, and what's who's in front of you, and the people who are around you, and your mission and purpose. And that is I mean, I know people have both too, you know, and that they believe in both, but for me, it sort of puts an urgency on it.
So what you're trying to say is, you suggest that people should be more like Garth from Wayne's World. Live in the now!
Yeah, yeah. And if there is a higher power, that's what I imagine it wants you to do. What else would it want you to do? You know, not do that? And it's a big part of AA, to the higher power is a big part. And I can say, like, for me, the process of finding something that worked, because I was on the spectrum of religious beliefs, I would put myself closer to kind of like the atheist camp. Like, it's like, I don't know, you know, I don't see it. One of the big tools I used, which I want to raise here just because it's like, I think a lot of people use it to avoid the question of a higher power, is like, God, either is all powerful and all knowing, or God is all good. But they can't. But it can't be both. And I took that to disprove all notions of higher power. Like, yeah, that's a big contradiction. More recently, I've become okay. I've understood the idea that contradictions are actually the essence of life, and that that's okay. You know, that's not an actual contradiction. Like, that is just both things are true equally.
Life's a fucking paradox, man.
Yeah, and I lean into that, and it gets me out of...
That's the thing, yeah. Is that you lean into it. Acceptance helps keep me sober today, helps keep me in recovery, helps keep me alive as a human being today.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict or you've been through sexual assault or any sort of trauma. You're going through life, and you're in recovery, and that's what matters. You are not alone.
Yeah.
Chris, what do you want your legacy as a human being to be? I know you don't believe in this afterlife idea that things go on forever. You have more of a scientific view of the end of life.
Mm-hmm.
When you are gone, what do you want your legacy as a human being to be with the people that are still alive in recovery on Earth?
Yeah, I mean, I want people to feel like I did my part. And I want to be able to feel like that too.
What's your part?
So that's a great question.
Thank you.
I don't know fully. I have a sense of it though. And I can use my higher power for that. I don't know the grand vision. I have a hard time with ideas like good and evil, or like my part is to be good. I have a hard time with it, you know, but I have a sense of what it means to do to play my role in life in a way that doesn't cause more problems, that doesn't make things worse. And I try to walk the opposite direction from that. And like, well, what does it look like for me to be a good family member or to be a good coworker, which I don't know how to do often. I have to ask for help. And for me, the more specific I can make my higher power and the smaller I can make it, the better. Like, I am of the sort of person where I have to ask my higher power for help to be present in a conversation after I go to the grocery store and I know I'm going to walk in my house. And I have to literally be like, oh my God, you know, have me not be self-centered and like wrapped up in my own thing when I get in, because there's going to be a person there who wants to have a relationship with me. And I have to do my job there. And it's for me, I have to ask for help for that little tiny things. And I try to put the purpose of life or the legacy of life into sometimes the smallest place I can.
How are you going to contribute to that purpose today? As in today, June 20th.
Yeah.
What are you going to do today?
Yep. So doing the show with some of it, I've never actually done like a presentation or an interview on my sobriety. I am backed up on work, and I can't procrastinate anymore. I need to do some things this afternoon, and I think that'll help my coworkers not wondering what I've been doing for the last few days. I got to catch up, and I want to be part of a team, and have them not resentful and wondering what's going on. There's a meeting later today that is on Zoom, and I help pull that together, and that's sort of my way of making coffee right now for the room or whatever. And it's great. I have to be there at 5, and I have to get ready and listen and be a part of it. And then when I go, it's not just about like, well, was that a good meeting for me or not, or did I get something out of that or not? It's like, did I play my part? In that thing that happened, like, was I an alcoholic amongst alcoholics in a real way? Was I present, helpful? Somebody asked for help. Did I just leave, or did I say like, "Hey, you said something. Do you want to talk about that more?" And if I can do those things, it's hard right now with COVID and Zoom to do that fully. But if I show up that way, it's great. I feel good, and I feel like I've left a little piece of that legacy that I want to leave, even though I can't like describe the whole thing. So that's the rest of my day. And then I got to spend some time with my partner tonight. It's been a busy few weeks here. and spend good time, not like watching Netflix. It's fine watching Netflix, but you can do more, and I need to do that. And all that stuff I'm going to have to ask for help for. It's the committee, you know. it's crazy.
Have people talk to your people. We'll get back to you.
And if I just if I just focus on that, like what is the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? It strings together in a direction.
The next right thing leads to the next right thing.
Yeah, and if I don't go much further than that, it's okay. And what I can say with certainty is that the next right thing leads to the next right thing, and that points in a totally different direction of where I was going. Mm-hmm. And that's fine with me right now. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was going west, I'm going east. That's okay. But I have a hard time with much more than that. So that's my day.
Beautiful. Sounds like a wonderful, fulfilling day.
It can be. It
sounds like a day of service.
Day of service, yeah.
Chris, thank you so much for being on Authentic today. You most certainly have been authentic. Your honesty, your purity, your selflessness, your loving kindness, compassion, your message of hope is going to prove invaluable. You have most certainly saved a life today. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. This is great.
You're very welcome. All right. That is the end of the show today. I know, but guess what? There will be another show next week. So don't be sad. Chris, would you like to try a sign-off line with me?
Absolutely.
I think I have the best one, but that is also a selfish thought. But I think it's pretty damn good.
I can't wait to hear it. Yeah.
Have you listened to my show before?
I didn't listen to the very... I have a terrible habit.
Gosh darn it.
I know.
Jerk.
Well, we'll practice it once and then we'll do it.
Okay. Well, I want to know what you got. And then I'll say mine.
Oh, no. I didn't plan to sign up. I didn't plan
it's
it.
Okay. That's the point. You have to be authentic and authentic.
Oh, man. What is the sign-off line? The thing I like the most. I don't use it as much as I should, but I feel like this was a great morning and it was really special. And so I was like I like Godspeed.
Okay, so you have to say it seriously, like you're actually signing off. So
Godspeed.
Say it one more time.
Godspeed.
That one was good.
That was the one.
That was the one. All
right. It's a good combination.
It is a great combination.
Yeah, you need both.
I dug it. All right, that is the show for today. Thank you so much for joining us here on Authentic, where Chris has gotten authentic.
As always, here on Authentic, in keeping authentic, we have to pay credit where credit is due. The musical stylings you heard on today's show to open it up, as always, you heard Mad Madness by Muse. And then we got into Chris's picks. All three picks by The Coup. First, you heard, oh yeah, Height. Then you heard Monsoon, and to take us off, Level It Up.
Bureau. Your money long like a churro, but that don't don't mean shit to us, cause the bank count down there zero. Now you see us standing in the shadow of a $5 bill, trying hard to pry off my collar still. Some try to deal through a whole lot of pills. We coming off the field and we all want meals. Got us flipping through the trap like an acrobat. Every hour we work, you snatch a stack. Meeting in the back, we want some of them racks. This is how we handle that.